Welcome to Orchard Conversations, a podcast brought to you by the Orchard community.
Hey, what is up, friends? I'm Scott Hodge, lead pastor of the Orchard community, and today we're taking a break from our series From Me to We to turn our focus on what's happening, what's transpiring over in the Middle East. It's a place that's very near to my heart, as many of you know, having spent time there in both Israel and Palestine, having made friends with many wonderful, beautiful people who are right now facing such awful atrocities. And so I thought what I would do is share a few thoughts. I'm not going to do this perfectly, that's for sure. But I guess what I'm aiming for is for us to take a moment to think about what it means to not only be a community that values peacemaking, but that actually finds ways to live, to live as peacemakers. So let's talk about this. Most of you know, unless you've been living, on another planet, which right now doesn't sound so bad, right? The most recent conflict between Israel and Hamas began on October 7th, about just a little over a month ago, when the Islamist militant group launched a surprise attack on Israel, killing 1,400 Israelis, kidnapping more than 240. It was unprecedented. Without a doubt, a horrible, horrible act. And in response, Israel declared war on Hamas, launching an air and ground offensive in Gaza. Since that time, almost 1.5 million Palestinians have left their homes since the war began. The civilian death toll in Gaza, it's reported, is now over 10,000 since the conflict began. 10,000. A majority of those women and children. Now, just to give you a bit of a perspective on this, there have been approximately 10,000 civilians killed in the Russian war against Ukraine over the last 9 months. 9 months, all right? The 10,000 that are dead in Gaza has occurred in less than 2 weeks. And this is not counting the 155 Palestinians that have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th, or the 250 Palestinians killed in occupied territory prior to the October 7th attacks. The UN is calling Gaza a children's graveyard. It is absolutely horrific all the way around. And of course, if you've been paying attention to the news, to social media, you'll know that there is quite a divide when it comes to who is supporting who, gosh, I mean, what we've been seeing in recent days is the kind of thinking that says, all right, if you don't support Israel's approach 100%, then you're an anti-Semite, right? Or if you speak out in support of Israel, then that means you hate Arabs or you hate Muslims, right? It's very polarized. And I think there's even a lot of confusion among Christians, especially Western evangelical Christians, many of whom, without taking time to really and truly understand the situation, understand history, are very quick to say, well, Jewish people are God's chosen people, so there's really no discussion here. God's on their side, so we're on their side. End of story. And so, it seems that what we're ultimately ending up with is one of two postures. One being pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian, or the other end of the spectrum, pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. What I'd like to suggest today is that neither one of those approaches, those ideologies, reflect the life and teachings of Jesus. And that there is indeed a better, more Christ-like posture for sure that we are invited to embrace. But first, let me say a couple things about Israel's war against Hamas. You have to know that this war did not start a month ago. No. The roots of this conflict trace back over 75 years at least, probably longer, shaped by a continuum of events that include the displacement of communities, forced resettlements, confinement, military strikes, occupation, support for apartheid-like policies, extrajudicial killings, all of which has planted the elements of a deeply unstable, perilous, fragile, to say the least, environment. So this is not a new war. It's been going on for a long, long time. The other thing I'd like to mention is that what's going on in Israel and Palestine is an incredibly complex situation. Some of you know, a few years ago, I had the privilege of spending about a week in Israel and in Palestine with a small group of friends and colleagues. And the purpose of the trip was essentially to learn and to try to understand both sides, both narratives. And so for 1 week straight, we spent time eating with, being in the homes of, and getting to know so many incredible and amazing Israelis and Palestinians. I'll tell you, it was an amazing and life-changing experience. You know, I mean, first of all, just experiencing the ancient sites, my gosh, I mean, where so much of our faith was birthed and formed, it was incredible. You know, visiting places like the Mount of Olives, right? The place where Jesus ascended into heaven, spent time teaching his disciples there. You know, the Garden of Gethsemane is there. Walking through the ancient city of Jerusalem, the old city, the city that was that was ruled by King David, whose walls were extended by his son, King Solomon. And then they were destroyed. And in 400 BC, this man named Nehemiah showed up and rebuilt them. It's so much, right? It's the same city Jesus rode on the back of a donkey through that he stopped and he looked out and he wept over the city. We visited places like Sea of Galilee, Capernaum, you know, Mount of Beatitudes, all the places. It was an epic and surreal experience, without a doubt. It was also quite disorienting. You know, the very first place we visited on our trip was a place known as Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem is Israel's official memorial to the Jewish victims of the Holocaust. It's huge. It's like over 2 million square feet that is dedicated to remembering the mass murder and genocide of approximately 6 million Jews during World War II. I think we were there for several hours, probably 3 or 4 hours, and we were on a private tour by this, I'll never forget, this 80-year-old Jewish man who shared story after story, often with tears in his eyes, about the travesty that forever altered an entire race of people, no doubt. So it was quite an experience, as you might imagine. I mean, leaving there, it was like already I could tell, we're going to leave here with more questions than answers, I think. That's probably going to be the case today, even watching this. Another part of the trip that comes to mind was when we visited Bethlehem. Little did I know how eye-opening the trip to Bethlehem would be. So picture this for a moment, all right? You're on your way to see where those of us who are Christians believe that the greatest event in human history took place, the birth of Jesus, the little town of Bethlehem, right? The place where we believe God took on flesh and moved into the neighborhood. But in order to get to Bethlehem, you have to make your way past a 28-foot high concrete wall. The Israelis call it a security wall. The Palestinians call it a separation wall. Israel started construction on the wall back in 2002. It was at the height of the Palestinian uprising that began a couple years earlier. The wall's not finished. It's about two-thirds built. But once it's completed, it's going to stretch 441 miles, and it will continue to divide the land and separating people. Here's a few photos of the wall. On the other side of that wall is another world known as the West Bank. So the West Bank, we've all heard of the West Bank. It's home to over 2.1 million Palestinians. It's where we find towns of Bethlehem and Nazareth and many other holy sites. Now, real quick, let me just put up a map of Israel, because a lot of people don't realize this, and they don't realize how small of a country Israel is. So Israel inhabits around 8,000 square miles. It's roughly the size of New Jersey. It's 260 miles long. And at its widest point, it stretches about 60 miles. Its narrowest point is only 9 miles. All right. So just to put this into perspective, you could literally take the entire country and sit it right smack dab in the middle of Lake Michigan and still have quite a bit of water left over. All right. It is a small piece of land, and it is the most disputed piece of land in the world. Now, let me just give you a metaphor, all right? And I know it's risky to do this because metaphors leave out a lot of nuance. They and a lot of things that are important. But I want to help you to try to understand what has sort of transpired over these past 75 years. And if you're Jewish or you're Palestinian, you're going to probably not like that I'm giving a metaphor for this, but I'm just trying to help people understand. So imagine for a moment that you have a piece of land with a big apple tree that gives delicious apples. Now imagine there are two groups of kids. One group has been playing near that apple tree for a long time. They feel that that tree is like a part of their playground. They've used its shade. They've climbed its branches. They've eaten its apples for years. All right. That group could be thought of like the Palestinians. Then there's another group of kids who used to play around that apple tree a long, long time ago, but who had to leave because they were essentially bullied away. But they've always remembered how great it was to play there. And so after many years, they've come back and they want to play there again because they remember that this is their special place too. So this group would be similar to the Jews, the Israelis. And so what you have now are both groups of kids who want to play under the same apple tree. And they both feel like they have good reasons why it should be theirs. And yet, no matter how hard they try, they cannot agree on how to share it. And sometimes they fight over who gets to play where and when. Well, after a long time of disagreement over who the land and who the apple tree belonged to, some of the villagers decided to draw lines in the soil. They said, all right, let's split the land so that everyone has a piece to take care of and we can all enjoy the apples. So in 1993, after much talking with the help of friends far away, these two groups shook hands and they agreed that certain parts of the land where the smaller apple trees grew, okay, aka the West Bank and Gaza, would be looked at by the Palestinians. This was done by what's called the Oslo Accords. And it was essentially saying, okay, you take care of these trees, we'll take care of those, and we'll work together and make sure everybody gets to enjoy some apples. And the agreement wasn't perfect. Not everyone was happy, but you know, it was a start. The idea was to find a way for them to live side by side, each taking care of their own trees while respecting the other's space. Well, unfortunately, even after drawing lines around the smaller trees, the two groups, they often argued about who should get the most water or the best sunlight for their trees. The bigger group who had the larger orchard sometimes didn't let water get to the smaller trees, making it hard for them to grow. And sometimes people from the group taking care of the smaller trees would sneak over to take apples from the big trees, which of course caused more trouble. Are you following me? All right. On top of that, okay, listen, some of the people from the larger group decided they wanted to plant new apple trees on parts of the land that wasn't designated as their land. They thought, okay, these parts of the land are really nice and they're pretty close to the big orchard, so why not expand? So these are like the Jewish settlements, which are essentially residential communities, towns, in some cases, like cities, built mostly by, I believe, religious Jews on land that has been legally recognized as Palestinian land. Now, the number of Israeli settlers living in the West Bank in the Palestinian territory has been rising steadily since the 1970s, hitting almost 430,000 settlers, Jewish settlers, in 2018. It's estimated today that there are as many as 700,000 Israeli settlers living illegally in the occupied West Bank. Some of you might remember earlier this year, the Israeli government approved plans for thousands of new housing units in the West Bank in the years to come, which, as you can imagine, makes it even more difficult for there to be much, if any, hope for an actual two-state solution for the Palestinians and Israelis. Which, interestingly enough, is something that the majority of Israelis and Palestinians agree is the best way to end the conflict. So anyway, take all of that Super simplified, way too simplified. I'm sure there could have been a better metaphor to use, but it's what I used, and I'm sorry if it's offended anyone, but you take all of that and combine it with everything else that the Palestinians face every single day of their life, such as restricted movement, checkpoints, barriers that limit the free movement of Palestinians, which affect their ability to reach jobs and schools and healthcare facilities and even family members. Control of resources. You know, Israel controls most of the water sources in the West Bank. They control the electricity in Gaza, which affects daily life. There are economic limitations. There's home demolitions and evictions. There is a significant military presence. I mean, this has been their reality for years and years and years. And then you add into the mix Hamas. There's so much about Hamas we don't have time to get into, but Hamas is like a group, going back to the analogy, like it's like a group from the smaller team who are very unhappy with how the bigger group's been treating them and how the apple trees have been shared. They think the smaller group should have more control over the land and apple trees, that they should have what was supposed to be theirs to begin with. And so they decide to take a more aggressive approach, which include everything from throwing rocks to shooting missiles to sending in suicide bombers to the horrific attack that happened just a few weeks ago. So you take all of that and all the other things, the nuances and the details that I don't have time to get into, and that frankly probably don't even know the half of. And it's pretty easy to see why this is such a complex and difficult situation. It is not simple. It is not black and white. There is no easy solution. And so, you know, I'm watching on TV people who are protesting on both sides, many of who I think have a good grasp on what's happening, but most of which I don't think really do. But anyway, it is a really, really, really difficult situation. And I think that's part of what it means as a peacemaker, means being willing to understand the situations are complex. Situations are not simple. They are not black and white, especially when it involves human beings. But I do know this. There are people who have been working for years and years and years and who have dedicated their entire lives to the grueling, difficult, hard, at times seemingly impossible work of peacemaking in the midst of it all. So I think about people I met, we met on this trip, people like General Sharoni, who is this 83-year-old retired Israeli general. At the time, I'm not sure if he still does or not, but at the time he led an organization called the Council for Peace and Security. He has dedicated these latter years of his life to finding peaceful, nonviolent solutions to this conflict. Another person we met who I just had such a great connection with, Sammy Awad. Sammy's an amazing person. He's a Palestinian Christian who leads an organization in Bethlehem called the Holy Land Trust. And it was such a great visit. I mean, he essentially just reminded us that nonviolent resistance is the only option. And he gave us a very direct warning. He said to us, he said, you know, the worst thing that could happen on this trip is for you to leave biased in one direction or another. Another couple people we met, Robbie and Mora, met these two amazing women in Tel Aviv. Robbie's a Jewish mother whose son was killed by a terrorist sniper a few years ago. Mora is a Palestinian wife who innocently lost her husband to an Israeli army bullet in 2010. And for the sake of peace, these two women have risen above the conflict and join together to form what's known as the Parent Circle. It's an amazing organization. It's a group of bereaved Israeli and Palestinian families who are working together to support peace, reconciliation, and tolerance. Robbie, in her message, she advises well-meaning people around the world, don't be pro-Israel. Don't be pro-Palestinian. Be pro-peace. Be pro-human. Pro Imago Dei, the image of God in each and every one. man, it is people like this who, along with the Spirit of Christ, is inviting us into a deeper conversation, into a deeper way of understanding. And I'll tell you, the message that we heard over and over and over again from those amazing people whose sleeves are rolled up, who are on the ground, who are doing the nitty-gritty, difficult work of peacemaking, the messages were messages like these. In the Holy Land, nobody wins unless everybody wins. Either Israel and Palestine learn to live together, or we will die together. Another message was this: if you're here to pick sides, go away. We don't need that kind of help. But if you're willing to figure out how to be a common friend to Israel and Palestine, then we welcome you. Man, these are the peacemakers. These are the people who Jesus says are blessed. Matthew 5, verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. How do we learn to live as peacemakers? Well, I think one of those ways is we have conversations like this. We try to put ourselves in a position to understand both sides. We're not afraid to dive into the difficult nuances, the difficult, the painful realities that people on both sides are facing. I think a good starting point is to learn everything we can from those who are actually doing that work. And so there's a couple things I'd love to do. One is I would love to point you to a resource that you can grab via the QR code that will be on your screen in just a moment. It's a PDF that we put together that links to several peacemaking resources. If you're watching this on Sunday online, you can click on the link in the chat window for that. But I want to encourage you to take this guide, if you want to call it that. Visit some of the links. Take some time, let it sink into you. And perhaps, and I think maybe the greatest thing that could happen is not just that you would have your heart turned towards Israel and Palestine, which I hope it is. Mine certainly is. I hope yours is too. It should be. And to other conflicts in the world, Ukraine, Russia, you know, let's just go on down the list, right? But what I would hope is that in your pursuit of understanding and learning about peacemaking, that you would take a look at your own life, that you would take a look at the people around you, and you would ask the question, where is peace needed? Where is shalom? Where is salam needed in my neighborhood or in my home or in my relationships? And that you would allow God to do some kind of deep work in you to live as the shalom maker, the salam maker, the peacemakers that Christ has called us to be. Listen, before we close out this part of our gathering, I want you to take a moment and watch and listen to this beautiful piece written and performed by actually one of my friends who was on our trip to Israel and Palestine, David Gunger. And it's performed by David Gunger and his band, The Brilliance. Open your heart now and watch these amazing visuals and listen to these amazing words. Shalom, friends.
Allah'a emanet olun.